Right now, as you listen to this, your brain is quietly burning about 20% of your body's total energy. And, I mean, if you are, like most people, a massive chunk of that battery power is just being completely wasted on a rogue software program running in the background.
Yeah, that pesky inner critic.
Exactly, the inner critic. You drop a coffee cup, and instead of just registering the accident, the voice immediately spirals. It's like, you are a clumsy, incompetent disaster, and, you know, this is why you will never succeed.
Right, and we tend to treat that voice as a character flaw or maybe just a bad mood, but it is actually a highly specific physical neurological process. Like, it has a location, a power source, and a biological mechanism.
Which is fantastic news, right? Because if it is biological, it means we can hack it. So today's deep dive pulls from a wild mix of material. We're looking at everything from functional MRI scans of jazz musicians in the zone to daily cognitive hacks used by clinical psychologists at the Cleveland and Mayo clinics.
Not to mention Dr. Judy Ho's work on reparenting and some really radical mindset evolution techniques from Chris Duncan and Dr. Joe Dispenza.
Yeah, exactly. Our mission today is to look under the hood of that negative self-talk, you know, to understand the specific brain networks responsible for our worst rumination. And we are going to explore powerful ways to change our internal programming from accessing flow states to a radical concept called recoding.
It is a journey from understanding the baseline anatomy of our anxiety to realizing we actually have the neuroplastic capability to completely alter our daily experience.
Okay, let's unpack this. Before we can stop the negative self-talk, we have to know where it lives, right? So where is the outlet for this inner critic?
Well, to find it, we have to look at the default mode network, or the DMN. Back in the late 90s and early 2000s, researchers like Shulman and Rachel made a very counterintuitive discovery.
What did they find?
They found a network of brain regions, chiefly the medial prefrontal cortex and the posterior cingulate cortex, that actually powers up when you stop doing specific externally focused tasks.
Wait, so if I am just staring out the bus window on my commute, not solving a puzzle or reading an email, my brain isn't powering down.
No, not at all. Yeah. It is actually shifting gears and booting up this entirely different network. It is the brain's default idle state.
Oh, wow. I always assumed resting just meant resting.
You would think so, right. And in a perfectly healthy system, the DMN is incredibly useful. It handles autobiographical memory, helps us plan for the future, and allows for deep self-reflection.
But let me guess, for most of us, it doesn't stay healthy.
Exactly. For the vast majority of us, this rest state devolves almost instantly into self-referential rumination.
Yeah, like overanalyzing a conversation from 3 years ago.
Or catastrophizing about a meeting next week, yeah.
But that raises a huge question, though. Why does it default to the negative? If the DMN has the power to reflect on anything, why doesn't my resting brain automatically assume everyone at work thinks I am a genius?
That comes down to a biological concept called cognitive miserliness, which Dr. Judy Ho talks about in her work.
Cognitive miserliness. What does that mean exactly?
Basically, the brain is an energy-hungry organ, but it is also incredibly lazy. It constantly seeks shortcuts to conserve calories.
Ah, so it just takes the path of least resistance.
Right. If you have spent years harboring negative thoughts about yourself, those neural pathways are already well established. It is physically cheaper, in terms of energy consumption, for your brain to just agree with a familiar negative thought.
Instead of burning calories to formulate a brand new positive one.
I see. That ties perfectly into Dr. Joe Dispenza's explanation of Hebbian learning. The old neurons that fire together, wire together rule.
Yeah, exactly. Repeated negative self-talk becomes physically hardwired. But it goes deeper than just firing together, doesn't it?
It does. When you repeat that negative self-talk, you are actually triggering a physical change in the brain's white matter.
Wait, really? Like structurally changing it?
Yes. The brain coats those frequently used neural pathways in a fatty substance called myelin. Myelin acts like insulation on an electrical wire.
Oh, so the more you ruminate, the thicker the myelin gets.
Exactly. And the faster and stronger that negative signal travels. You are literally paving a superhighway for your inner critic.
Man, that is intense. And then if you throw chronic stress or trauma into the mix, that superhighway just gets hijacked.
That is where the amygdala comes in.
The brain's primitive fear center.
Yeah, the amygdala essentially takes the wheel of the DMN. Studies show this leads to weakened connectivity in conditions like depression. The brain locks into predictive coding.
Which means it is constantly scanning the horizon for threats, assuming the absolute worst-case scenario to keep us safe.
Right. It anticipates negative events and creates a locked-in state of negative thoughts as a twisted survival mechanism.
This feels like having a smartphone where the background operating system is secretly running a malware virus. Like, the negative self-talk is the malware, and it is completely draining the battery, which is our emotional energy.
That is a highly accurate analogy.
But here is my pushback. If this network is physically insulated with myelin and hardwired by evolution to keep us hypervigilant and stuck in the past, are we just biologically doomed to be at the mercy of our own worst critics?
I know it sounds bleak when you lay out the anatomy, but no, we are absolutely not doomed. We actually have mechanisms to turn this network off.
Okay, phew. What is the off switch?
The most potent, scientifically observable way to quiet this network is through what we call flow states.
Oh, I love flow states. That is when you are so immersed in an activity that time just seems to vanish, right? You forget to eat, you forget you're tired.
Exactly. You forget your own ego. Flow occurs when there is a perfect balance between the challenge of a task and your current skill level.
Right, because too much challenge brings anxiety and too much skill brings boredom.
Spot on. Hit the sweet spot and you enter flow.
Yeah.
We can actually see this happen in functional MRI scans of people doing everything from playing Tetris and Pong to expert jazz musicians improvising.
So what is happening in their brains neurologically?
It is a phenomenon called transient hypofrontality.
Transient hypofrontality. Okay, break that down for me.
Transient means temporary, and hypofrontality means a decrease in blood flow and activity in the frontal regions.
So the front part of their brain is essentially taking a nap.
Yes. The medial prefrontal cortex, which is a core DMN node linked to self-referential thought, is actively downregulated.
The inner critic literally gets turned down.
Literally. Simultaneously, the executive control network, or ECN, engages to handle complex tasks, and the amygdala quiets down.
Which explains why time vanishes. If the timekeeper and the ego are powered down, you are just pure awareness. The critic loses its power supply.
Think of the brain like a city's power grid. There's a finite amount of electricity.
Right.
When that jazz musician starts improvising, the brain has to power up the ECN. To get the energy for that, it steals electricity from the DMN. The lights literally go out on your inner critic.
That is a brilliant way to visualize it. It's like being in a crowded, noisy room. The DMN is the loud, anxious person shouting in the corner, and entering flow is like putting on high-end noise-canceling headphones.
I like that. The noise is just gone.
But I have to raise a practical constraint here. Flow is incredible, but you cannot play Tetris or improvise jazz 24/7. What happens when we have to go back to normal life, the headphones come off, and the critic wakes back up?
That is the daily reality we all face. Since you can't live in a permanent flow state, the strategy has to shift to day-to-day cognitive management.
Okay, so how do we handle the DMN when it inevitably reboots?
The first psychological tool is creating immediate physiological distance by naming the critic.
Literally giving it a name.
Yeah, one of the sources uses the example of naming the voice Brian.
Brian. Wait, because it is an anagram for brain.
Exactly. It reminds us that we are not our thoughts. We are just the person listening to them.
Oh, I like that. So when Brian starts catastrophizing, I don't absorb it as my identity. I can just say, thanks for your input, Brian, but I'm busy.
Right. It immediately stops the DMN from blending with your core sense of self. Another major tool comes from the Cleveland Clinic, and it is the strategy of neutral thinking.
Neutral thinking. How does that differ from just trying to be really positive?
Well, forcing toxic positivity doesn't work, and it feels insincere. If you feel terrible, standing in the mirror yelling, "I am perfect and everything is amazing," causes cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, your brain absolutely knows you were lying.
It does. And your amygdala spots the discrepancy, registers it as a conflict, and actually releases cortisol, the stress hormone.
Wow. So trying to be overly positive actually stresses the brain out more. That is wild.
Which is why neutral thinking is the bridge. Instead of catastrophizing like, "I failed, I'm useless," you strip the emotion away and stick to the sterile facts.
So something more like, "I failed, it is disappointing, but I can learn a new way."
Precisely. It is factually true. So it doesn't trigger the amygdala's alarm system, and it doesn't feed the DMN's rumination loop.
It's just grounded reality. It reminds me of the reparenting techniques Dr. Judy Ho talks about.
Yes, the reparenting affirmations are huge.
Like telling yourself, "I can handle what comes my way," instead of trying to convince yourself you're a superhero.
Exactly. Those techniques soothe the nervous system because they gently steer the DMN away from panic without setting off the brain's bullshit detector. You can also combat cognitive distortions using tools like the AI chatbot WISA, or just doing two-column journaling.
So what does this all mean? We have these cognitive tools. We've got journaling, chatbots, naming the voice Brian, reparenting ourselves.
It is a solid toolkit.
It is, but I have to be completely honest, it all feels a bit exhausting.
In what way?
Well, it feels like we're playing a never-ending game of whack-a-mole with our own biology. Brian pops up, I neutralize him. Brian pops up again, I reparent him.
I hear you.
Is there a way to actually rewrite the baseline software instead of just constantly patching these daily bugs?
That exact fatigue is what leads us to the most radical paradigm shift in modern neuroscience and psychology. It is the fundamental difference between trying to fix a broken self versus recoding your baseline entirely.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
It really does. We see this shift in the magnetic mind method developed by Chris Duncan. His framing undercuts the entire traditional therapeutic model.
What is his foundational premise?
It is simply this: you are not broken.
Wow, that flies in the face of a lot of traditional self-help, which kind of assumes you are a damaged machine that requires years of digging through your past to repair.
Exactly. Duncan realized he was stuck in this oscillating pattern-building success, then letting the inner critic sabotage it. The breakthrough came from a billionaire mentor who told him, "You have to be it before you see it."
That sounds a bit like a motivational poster, though. What does a rapid recode protocol actually look like in practice?
Well, instead of oscillating in past trauma or analyzing why your DMN is negative, the method focuses entirely on the superconscious.
The superconscious. Okay.
In live events, Duncan demonstrates this by bringing someone with a profound fear of public speaking on stage. Instead of talking about their childhood, he has them engage in specific breath work and vivid visualization.
So they just visualize being confident on stage.
They focus entirely on the sensation of the end result they desire. By pairing a clear intention with an elevated emotion, they actively shift blood flow away from the amygdala and begin laying down new neural pathways in real time.
They actively choose to remove their fear in moments, just pulling the energy out of the resistance. And I know there are certified practitioners doing this work now, like Greg Jones down in New Zealand.
Yes, applying this exact recoding process to daily life.
But how does someone actually make this transition from doing to being without it just feeling like fake it till you make it? I mean, how can visualizing change the brain?
Because it is backed up by the hard neuroscience of mental rehearsal. Take Dr. Joe Dispenza's famous piano experiment.
Oh, I think I know this one. Break it down for us.
Researchers took two groups of people who had never played the piano. Group A physically practiced one-handed exercises for 2 hours a day for 5 days. Group B only mentally rehearsed playing the exact same exercises.
Wait, Group B never touched a physical keyboard?
Never once. But the brain scans after 5 days were staggering. The group that only mentally rehearsed grew the exact same neural circuits as the group that physically practiced.
That is insane. The physical architecture of the brain changed purely from thought.
It proves that the brain does not know the difference between an external physical reality and a vividly imagined internal thought. You leverage neuroplasticity to build the physical architecture to match the new state.
It is like a GPS system. Traditional therapy can sometimes be like endlessly analyzing the wrong turns you took in the past, but recoding is simply typing in the new destination and hitting go.
That is a perfect analogy. You stop driving down the old heavily paved highway of negative self-talk and you start bushwhacking a new path in the jungle.
And every time you vividly imagine that future state with elevated emotion, you walk that path again until it becomes the new highway.
Yes. The emotion is the biochemical catalyst. You release dopamine and oxytocin ahead of the actual experience. You aren't faking it. You are biologically becoming it before you see it.
You are building the hardware to run the new software. It is profoundly empowering.
It really is.
So to bring this full circle for you listening, we have covered a massive amount of ground today. We started by mapping the anatomy of the inner critic, locating it in the default mode network.
Right, and understanding how cognitive miserliness and myelin hardwire those negative loops.
Then we explored how transient hypofrontality during flow states gives us a biological off switch, temporarily redirecting the brain's power grid.
We looked at daily management too, like creating distance with Brian and using neutral facts to avoid cortisol spikes.
And finally, we moved past management entirely into recoding, the realization that you are not broken and that through vivid mental rehearsal, you can prune away the old highways of self-doubt and build entirely new neurological architecture.
Which leaves us with a fascinating, entirely new question to consider.
Let's hear it.
If neuroscience proved that your brain literally cannot tell the difference between a real event and a vividly imagined one, What reality is your inner critic currently building for you? And what reality will you choose to mentally rehearse instead?
Now that is something to chew on. Next time that familiar voice tries to play the I'm the worst song on repeat, just remember, you aren't just the listener. You own the radio station. Catch you on the next deep dive.